God looked upon Zion at that time as a drunken woman, drunken mother, with no son to lead her or to guide her. In other words, there's a picture of dejected loneliness and of dejection in sin and what she had done. I notice you have drunken the bowl of the cup of staggering. You've drained it. There is none to guide her among all the sons whom she had brought forth. Neither is there any that taketh her by the hand among all the sons that she has. Two things are befallen and so on. Now here we see Zion in this very depressed condition, a very lowly condition. Now this is in this chapter, chapter 51, along with others. Now in chapter 52 and through the latter part of 52 and 53, here we see the servant. Here is the servant, now Jehovah's servant, who came to bear our sin, that he might redeem a people unto himself. That's in that 53rd chapter, beginning with 52 and verse 13. One of the truly great chapters of the Old Testament. Now, in chapter 55, now we see Zion redeemed by the servant. Now, here then is Zion redeemed, God's people, God's city, God's dwelling place among men. Then, that's chapter 54. Now, in chapter 55, here is the great invitation of God to all mankind to come unto him and find salvation and mercy in that which he's provided in the servant. Now, you see in this a foreshadowing of the condition, the condition at that time. But you see a foreshadowing of the condition of God's people. And then the servant comes to redeem. Then you see the glorious people beyond his coming. And that, of course, is the church, God's redeemed people. Now, let's look at chapter 54. And so now here is the development out of chapter 49 and verse 14. Let me look back at that for just a moment. In chapter 49 and verse 14, but Zion said, Jehovah hath forsaken me, and the Lord hath forgotten me. Can a woman forget a sucking child that she should not have compassion on the son of a womb, is God's response? Yea, these may forget, yet will not I forget thee. Graven thee from the palms of my hand, you're always before me. Right, now, I think that that's taken up now, or answered, here in chapter 54 out here now, God's attitude toward them. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not sing. Here, let me start over. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith Jehovah. Now, what was the desolate? I think that looks back to the promise that God made in Abraham, that in thee shall all the family of the earth be blessed, and in thy seed all the families shall be blessed. But now then, that promise was left, and God redeemed, took unto himself a physical nation, a physical people, the descendants of Abraham. Now, although they had become a great nation, now yet when the servant comes, the seed of Abraham, the seed of the woman, God's son, when he comes, then the children of the desolate, that is the promise, the spiritual promise, then they will be more than the children of the physical promise, of the physical woman. Now, Paul says that these two women present an allegory. He didn't say they are an allegory. That, he says, they present an allegory, they represent an allegory. Now, a lot of people have said that there's no such really thing back there, just as an allegory. No, Paul didn't say that. Paul says that which contain an allegory, that in the fourth chapter of Galatians. So here you have in that which contains an allegory. Mount Sinai, back here, was typical of the physical people, and over Mount Zion, the spiritual. And back here, Ishmael symbolized the physical people. Isaac symbolized those of promise. And that Paul points that out there. So I conclude from Paul's use of this passage, and he quotes this passage, I conclude from Paul's use of this passage that he's talking there about the spiritual promise, which was desolate for so long, but when it is fulfilled, there'll be more children of the spiritual promise than there were of the physical. That is what he is saying. You know, that's the use Paul made of it in Galatians, the fourth chapter. So then he calls upon them that were desolate to sing, now that didst not travail, that did not have children, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith Jehovah. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thy habitation. Spare not. Lengthen the cords and strengthen the stakes. Now, there's the picture of enlarging a great tent. Now, because there are going to be so many more now than there were. So the figure is, enlarge the place of your habitation for the spiritual, and we've already had that earlier, that they said that the way is too straitened for us. We're going to need more land. Right, so now God says, enlarge your tent, lengthen the cords, and strengthen the stakes. Well, it'll take bigger stakes here, long and stronger cords here, or ropes here, to support a larger tent. So the idea is that you need and have a larger habitation than you had before. Well, Zechariah says his dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Well, both of those ideas, passages rather, are suggestive of the enlarged Zion and the enlarged tent, the enlarged area that she will possess. So enlarge the place of thy tent and let them stretch forth the curtains. Those are the curtains that make up the tent. Lengthen thy cords, strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt spread abroad on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall possess the nations, and make the desolate cities, I think those are the spiritual cities, to be inhabited. Those spiritual places, spiritually desolate places, will be inhabited by spiritual people. Now, know thy seed here. Now, look back up here at verse 11 in chapter 53. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquity. Now, on verse 10, excuse me. Verse 10. Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. Now here, when this servant offers himself for sin, he will prolong his days. That indicates that his resurrection, continuity of life, as I said last Wednesday night. Then furthermore, he will see his seed, that is the spiritual offspring, the result of his sacrifice. He will see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in him. What God was pleased to do in human redemption will prosper in him. Now in the 54th chapter, now here are the redeemed people. Now notice he says here, and his seed, or thy seed, shall possess the nation and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. And so this then is the consequence and result of the sacrifice of the servant, of his redemptive sacrifice as the Lamb of God. Now, God is foretelling all of this. That's why I think, and why Jesus could say, if you had known your law and your prophets, you'd recognize me. You'd know it. If they had just known the law, they didn't know it. They'd misread the whole thing. They'd made it simply a system of human traditions when the Lord came. Now, he moves on. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, for thou shalt not be put to shame, for thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and the reproach of thy widowhood shalt thou remember no more. Now, I think that the shame of a youth was her idolatry. When they came out of Egypt, Amos says that you bear your idols even in the wilderness. And they did. They built that golden calf there. They still had the idols in their hearts. Were their little idols carried with them? I don't know. But I do know that they were still idolaters when they came. I think that was the shame of her youth. Now, her widowhood was that period when God forsook the city back in Ezekiel, the 11th chapter. I remember studying that, where in a vision, Ezekiel saw the chariot of Jehovah ascend over the court of the tabernacle and then go eastward over to the mount across the valley there. Right, so God had left his people, and he left them to go into captivity. But remember, if we had this thought back here in chapter 51, you remember, hearken when he says back here, no, chapter 50, thus saith Jehovah, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, wherewith I put her away? Or which of my creditors is it whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities you were carried. Now God never gave Judah a writing of divorcement. He gave Israel a bill of divorcement, according to Jeremiah 3. He gave Israel, the northern kingdom, a bill of divorcement, but he never gave Judah one. So therefore, he could take them back. Now, if God had given her a writing of divorcement and put her away, according to Deuteronomy 24, I think he could not have done that which he forbade his people to do. If a man sees some unseemly thing in his wife, wants to put her away, let him give her a writing of divorce and put her away. If the man she marries finds something there and put her away, the first husband cannot take her back. Well, all right. So if God did not allow his people to do that, could he have done that? Well, I think not. Be consistent with his law there. Because that law was a principle that expresses its own character. So now then, here was a period of widowhood. That is, when God had allowed them to go into captivity, a period of 50 years, they were in Babylon. And so I think that's what he's talking about here. Now when he says, forget the shame of your youth, which I think was idolatry, and the reproach of thy widowhood shalt thou remember no more. Now that was when she went into captivity, the result of her idolatry. So here are conditions now that have been overcome, you see, in Christ. Now notice further. For thy maker is thy husband, Jehovah of hosts is his name. And the Holy One of Israel is thy Redeemer. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. Now notice he's her maker. Now if he could make the nation, and he did, take it to himself, he can also redeem that nation. And that's what he has done. He redeemed unto himself a people for his own possession, which is now a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, according to 1 Peter. So now here then, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. Now notice, he's going to be more than just the God of Israel or Judah. He's going to be the God of the whole earth. Now, some commentators try to apply this to the return of the Jews from captivity in Babylon. You can't do it to save your life. There's no way in the world that their return fits into this, into what he's going to do here. But the salvation in Christ, in the servant, yet does. And that's what we have in, are you talking about? For Jehovah hath called thee as a wife, forsaken and grieved in spirit, even a wife of youth, that is, she's not still young, but he chose her in youth, when she is cast off, saith thy God. Now, she'd been cast off for this period in Babylonian captivity. Now, God's going to bring her back, a remnant, and then he's going to claim that remnant, but eventually, he will fulfill the spiritual promise that in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That will take place in Christ. He brought back a remnant unto himself, but the real redeemed people will be under the Messiah. Right, now notice further here, I think I'm correct in that. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. Now small moment, 50 years in comparison to the whole history from Abraham on down, we're just a small portion of it. So now for a small moment I have forsaken thee, but it's not permanent. I'm going to bring you back unto myself. In overflowing wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting loving kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith Jehovah thy Redeemer. Now that's a great passage. Beginning here with verse 4 here. Don't fear, don't be afraid, for though God cast you off for a moment, I'm going to take you back. He never gave him a writing of divorcement. He had, as I say, I think he couldn't have, because he didn't take Israel back. Only the individual might come back. Well, all right. Now notice further here. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me, for as I have sworn that the waters of Noah shall no more go over the earth, so have I sworn that I will not be wroth with thee, nor rebuke thee. Now he's talking about the redeemed people now. Right? Now, I know he's not talking about Judah. I mean the return from Babylon in this. Why? Because when they came back, he was wroth with them, and destroyed the city and the people with a Roman soldier, the Roman of empire, when they rejected the Christ and rejected God and became come to the point they were no longer fit to live. But now let's think about spiritual Zion for just a moment. Spiritual Israel. He knows what he continues to say about spiritual Israel now. But as God swore back yonder, I'll never destroy the world again with a flood, and he hasn't. And he won't. He also has sworn that I'll not destroy this spiritual Zion. It'll never be brought to an end. Now notice further here. I will not be wroth with thee, nor rebuke thee, for the mountains may depart, and the hills be removed. But my loving kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall my covenant of peace be removed, saith Jehovah, that hath mercy on thee. Now, for a Sunday or two ago, we talked about this covenant of peace that God talks about as an eternal covenant. An eternal blood. It's a covenant of peace, Hebrews 13:20. We called it that a covenant of peace there. Brought forth with the blood of an everlasting covenant. Yeah, that's right. It's an everlasting covenant. And here by the blood of the peace of Christ. I didn't bring my testament. I don't know why I didn't tonight. But it didn't. That's all right. We'll go ahead. You remember the passage. So now then, my covenant of peace shall not be removed. Now notice, for all thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted, behold, I will set thy stones in fair colors, and lay thy foundation with sapphires. In other words, he's using a glorious picture here of the church, or the new spiritual temple, which will be the church. And it's going to be glorious with a foundation and walls and all of that. Now notice he goes on here. Set in stones of fair colors, or menica. Antimony is a stone, I don't know which it meant. And lay thy foundation with sapphires. And I will make thy pinnacles. Now what those pinnacles were, not sure. Whether they were windows or whether they were the borders here or on the top of the top of it. Don't know just what that meant. And I will make thy pinnacles of rubies and thy gates of carbuncles. And all thy border of precious stones. Now, whatever those may mean, and the Hebrew scholars are not sure just what those stones are, what they mean. But here we know the point. The point is, here's the glory of the new temple. The glory of the new temple is thus to come, but it's going to be spiritual. So it simply is presenting the glory of the spiritual temple under Christ. And it certainly is. It's a glorious temple. As Paul said, that you may know the exceeding greatness of his power, the preciousness of the saints in his sight. It shows how precious the saints are in God's sight. Now, notice verse 13. And all thy children shall be taught of Jehovah, and great shall be the peace of thy children. Now, I spoke on that a couple of Sundays ago on the covenant. Take Jeremiah 31:31-34 in this passage. Where God said, the day is come that I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. They shall not teach every man his fellow citizen, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. That is, before now, and I think I illustrated that, now back here on the Old Testament here, here was an individual born, right, into the family of God. Now he was circumcised the eighth day, and thus considered then a part of the Abrahamic family. Right now then, following that, he had to be taught. He didn't know a thing at that time. Right now. Over there in the new is different. Under here now, he's going to be taught before he's brought into this covenant relationship with God. So they'll not teach every man that all thy children shall be taught of Jehovah. Great shall be the peace of thy children. And I made the observation of those two passages, along with the quotation of Jeremiah in Hebrews 8, and verses 6 to 13, that completely dynamites the foundation from under infant baptism. Because they're going to have to be taught first. And so both prophets here, so here they were born, circumcised, that is, brought into covenant with God, and then taught. Over there taught, brought into covenant relationship over here, and then of course they continue to be taught and to live in this relationship with God. Right? So, I don't know why men can't understand that, don't see that. But that's clear, not only the prophecy point out, but even the New Testament, they always baptize men and women. Never children. All right? Much less babes. Now let me move on here now. And all thy children shall be taught of Jehovah. In righteousness shalt thou be established. Thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for he shall not come near to thee. Now that is, men may attack you. Men may try to destroy you, but they can never destroy you. Man can never destroy the church of the Lord. Now, I can reject it. We can destroy ourselves from within. But there are no forces from without that can destroy the church of our Lord. None, whatever. Only as we yield to them. So he moves on now. In righteousness thou shalt be established. So it's in the righteousness of Christ, as we imbibe that and enter into that righteousness, that we're established. You're not established by a fleshly relationship. You're not established by that. Fleshly relationship, or by numbers, or by wealth, or by show. We're not established by any of these things. We are established by righteousness. That's why the establishment takes place. We're established in righteousness. All right? Thou shalt be far from oppression. Now look further here. Behold, they may gather together, but not by me. That is, those individuals in a stir of strife that are against you. Now remember that God brought the Assyrians against Israel and Judah. Isaiah the 10th chapter, we emphasize that. He brought the Chaldeans against Judah 135 years later. A whole the Chaldeans there. Went. He said that in Habakkuk 1, that he was bringing them. Now, but now God says any attack against spiritual Zion, here's the Zion we're talking about here. Now here, this is spiritual Zion, the redeemed Zion. Now any attack against spiritual Zion or effort to destroy spiritual Zion will not be by Jehovah. Now he looks at the individuals. Now it may be that we'll suffer from without. There'll be attempts to destroy the church, always have been, or it will be. But there'll be no judgment by Jehovah brought against the church in the sense of an oppressor or these things. Now you remember back in the Judges, God raised up the oppressors there, and then raised up a deliverer. Then when it came to Assyria, and then when it came to Babylon and Rome to destroy the city, all of those were brought by Jehovah against the old system and order, but against the new it will not be by him. Alright, behold, they may gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall because of thee, because you're mine, and they're going to fall. Well, that's pointed out in Zechariah, the 14th chapter, in a very picturesque passage there, where individuals are coming against the spiritual Jerusalem, and there they'll die, there their eyes will go back in the sockets and all that. A very grotesque picture in that 14th chapter of Zechariah, but it is a picture of the defeat of all who come against spiritual Zion in an effort to destroy it. Now it may look sometimes as though our number is very small. It may look sometimes as though there are very few who are holding fast and fighting the battle, but there will always be a few. God will always have his remnant. It looked there for a time as if the Roman Empire was going to destroy the Church of the Lord. Then when it didn't and Roman Catholicism grew up, it looked there for a while as though Roman Catholicism was going to destroy the remnant of God's people. But it didn't. It didn't. And it looks today as if the world and worldliness and error and all this may destroy the church, but it won't. It'll never destroy it. Now that's the point in Revelation 20, when the devil is loose for a little time, just before the end, gathers Gog and Magog, and these are the opponents and enemies of the cause of God. These are going to come up against the camp of the saints. But then when they do that, then fire will come forth and devour them. The devil will be cast into the lake of fire, and the saints will be presented unto God in the eternal state. So it's an encouraging thing, folks, that what Isaiah says here, 2,000 years, and that still stands. No enemy ever come against the church and destroyed it. Back down in the French period of the French Renaissance, while the French infidelity and atheism, while they attempted to destroy and blot out Christianity, they said, we're going to rid ourselves of it. They failed. Humanism today is trying to destroy it. They failed. We may be in that little period in Revelation. I can't think we are, but we may not. I don't know. But anyhow, the devil's gathering these forces now, spiritual forces, moral forces. Now, not political. I mean, not military. You don't want to destroy it, try to destroy the church militarily. You can't do that. It's spiritual. But spiritual forces, he uses it to try to destroy it. But he'll fail. He'll fail. Well, all right. So he moves on that. And he goes on to say, now notice further. Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the fire of coals and bringeth forth a weapon for his work. And I have created the waster to destroy. Now notice. Here is the smith that makes the weapon. Here's the weapon that for his work of destruction. Here's the waster. That's the individual who would waste the nation, waste the forces that are good, try to waste it. Now God says, I use it, I make those. But now notice further, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. Now notice that. No weapon can ever, God makes the smith who makes the weapon who becomes the waster of nations or people. But God says, none of them will make a weapon to come against you to destroy you. We can only be destroyed from within. And that's the tragedy of a lot of the situation exists today. All right? Now, and you condemn them. This is the heritage of the servants of Jehovah and their righteousness, which is of me, said Jehovah. You're established in righteousness. Now here then are the servants. Now here the servant Now, over here, these, over here, the redeemed, are the servants. Now, that we've had Israel was a servant, Israel and Judah was a servant, Cyrus was a servant, Babylon was a servant, we are and here is the servant, Christ, and we are servants. You've got those three or four or five different categories of servant in the book of Isaiah. Well, to me, that's very fascinating. The very fact that Isaiah so completely foretold that, that was Jesus came and did and has continued to carry out from that time until now, and will carry it out to the end of time. Doesn't that give you courage and confidence and assurance and faith? I mean, surely it ought to. It ought to make us realize it makes a difference. What the devil throws against us, he still can't destroy us. As long as we abide and established in righteousness, you can never destroy righteousness. All there will always be that which is right as over against that which is not right. And so that which is not right will be destroyed. Righteousness coming from God is permanent. Now in the 55th chapter, we're there before us now. Now comes the great invitation. Well, it sounds almost like Jesus, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, and so on now. Right now notice, hold everyone that thirsteth. Come ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come ye buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Now notice he said, if you got no money, come and buy. How can I buy without money? Well, this is something that I don't buy with money. I secure this by accepting it by a change of mind and heart that enables me to accept and receive that. Now, these being the thirsty, the spiritually thirsty, the spiritually hungry. Now, notice here, come and buy and eat, and that's the bread or food. Come and buy wine. That cheers the heart, the Bible says. And then milk, that we grow thereby. Peter said, desire the sincere milk of the word, that you may grow thereby unto salvation. So here then is bread, here is milk on which to grow, here is wine to cheer the heart of the individual. All right? Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Why? Why do we spend our time and our labor on that which really, I know we've got to have something to eat, don't misunderstand, I'm talking about that. But why put the material things, give them such emphasis in our life? When in reality, if we turn out to be millionaires, I still didn't buy us anything of happiness. That's one lesson that the book of Ecclesiastes teaches. Now here was Solomon, he became the wisest man of all, but it was vanity and a striving after wind. Then he set himself there to pleasure, and he gave himself to pleasures. And that was vanity also. And then he gave himself to building a great garden and a great palace and all of that. And he became very wealthy. But when he accumulated all that his wisdom, and his wealth, and his pleasure, and his God power, and all of that, his conclusion was, it's all vanity, and a striving after wind. And though he goes on to teach, that book does, that an individual with enough to eat, let him therewith be content. And if I've got a place to live, and a living, be content with that. Contentment with godliness is a great gain. We brought nothing into the world, neither can we carry anything out. So that having food and clothing, let us therewith be content. Contentment is a great thing to gain in life. Well, all right. Now, I think that's what he's talking about here then. Come and find the truly spiritual, the truly worthwhile. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and that which is not good for you? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good. And let your soul delight itself in fatness, spiritual fatness. Let your soul delight itself in that which is spiritual and that God provides. Class, that's an awful hard lesson to learn. I know that. I know that very few of us learn that. When we get so much, we want so much more. And when we get that, well, we still want to add to that and want more. Why? Why? If I've got something to eat and to drink and pretty good health and a way to get around and a house to stay in, what more do I really need? Might like some more, want some, but that's what I need. Now, that's what he's trying to teach us here. It's the teaching of Jesus taught the same thing. He's foretelling here what Jesus would teach concerning this spiritual kingdom here. Incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Now, notice that incline your ear, turn your ear and hear what I've got to say. And hear. Now to hear is not just to let the words go in. I know what the words were. But it's to take them to heart and make them a part of your life. hear, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant, even the sure mercies of David. Now, Paul quoted that in Acts, the 13th chapter, which we dealt with a few Sundays ago when we went over that, 13th chapter, about verse 34 and 5 there, when he speaks that of the covenant of God and even the everlasting, the sure mercies of David. Now, what were they? It was the fact that God promised David that God would make, set up his seed as king and establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Now, in the establishing of that spiritual throne and spiritual kingdom, there would be found the sure mercies in that realm, of that spiritual realm, that God had promised unto David back there. Paul quotes that and applies it to the present time. All right, so he moves on now. Behold, I've given him for a witness to the people. That is, that's the Christ. Now, that's the new spiritual David. Now, David is spoken of a number of times. I think I can find two or three of those passages over here. In Jeremiah, about the 30th chapter, I think. He there speaks of the of David here. Well, no, he doesn't, 34, so move on over a little bit there. Talk here. All right, when he says, yes, the 33rd chapter, what I'm looking for. Now, notice what he says here in verse 16. In those days shall Judah be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell safely. And this is the name whereby she shall be called, Jehovah our righteousness. Now, you see, that's what we had Isaiah said. He will be established in righteousness. Now, note further. For thus says Jehovah, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel, neither shall the priest, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings and peace offerings and so on. All right, now that the priest there will be in the Melchizedek priesthood, where there David's descendant, this David that he's talking about here, will be the king and the priest there. Well, that's one part. There's another passage too there that I've missed, but look over now to the 34th chapter of Ezekiel. Look what Ezekiel says here about this David also. And drop down here to about verse 23. And I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. And I, Jehovah, will be their God, and my servant David, priest among them. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. All right, so that Jeremiah and Ezekiel both speak of this one to come as David. And he is the offspring of David. Now look also at Hosea. Hosea 3 and verse 5. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek Jehovah their God, and David their king, and shall come with fear unto Jehovah and to his goodness in the latter days. Now the latter days always refers to the Messianic period. I've never found an exception to that. So here then, in the latter days, the Messianic period, here they have come unto David their king. David will be their king and priest and their shepherd, according to Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Hosea. So here is the David, now that he's talking about back here, the sure mercies of David. That is, all that God has promised in the seed of David will be fulfilled in that seed. I'm getting myself across here. Are you following me here in this? And so these prophets are looking to the descendant of David, whom they refer to as David, that shall come, and the sure mercies that God promised in him will be yours. What is that? That's a kingdom with a king, salvation, redemption, remission of sins, all of that will be in him. And Paul said that we've received that. So if we've received it, what are the millennialists arguing for when Christ comes back? It's an empty argument. And hasten along. We move on down now. When he says here, behold, I have given him for a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander of the people. Now, a leader is one on the top who guides and directs. A commander is one who issues orders. So he's both the leader and the one who issues the orders for the people of God. Behold, thou shalt call a nation that thou knowest not, and a nation that knew not thee shall run unto thee, because of Jehovah thy God, and for the Holy One of Israel, for he hath glorified thee. In other words, to Zion. Now here the people will come, and here will be a nation that hadn't existed before, and it hadn't. It's a brand new kingdom. I pointed that out a couple of Sundays ago when I talked about receiving a kingdom that cannot be destroyed. This is a new kingdom. Peter described it as a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. It's a holy nation. When the Lord said that I have other sheep and they're bringing in, Lord, and have one kingdom and one shepherd. No, that's not the passage I want. I'm thinking about another statement that he made there, but it doesn't matter. I'll pass over that slip of mine. Okay, let me move on. Finish up this lesson. Let me finish this up now. Seek, now comes the invitation, is further emphasized. Now up here, oh, everyone come. Now here's the invitation, is further emphasized. Seek ye Jehovah while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Now here, let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto Jehovah, and he will have mercy and upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Now, and that's what it means to seek Jehovah, is to call upon him, forsake wickedness, and turn to him in righteousness. That's seeking him. Now notice, it gives four fours here. Four different times. Now notice this four here. You need four times here. That means for this cause, or for this reason, or because of this. Now note, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith Jehovah. That's one reason for seeking Jehovah. His thoughts are not our thoughts. We want to conform ours to his. Now note, second, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now when you look out into the infinite space and think of the infinity out yonder, we call the sidereal heavens. Right? Now, God's thoughts and ways are so much higher than ours, as the heavens are, than we are. His are infinite, ours are finite. That's the second reason for seeking. Third, verse 10. For as the rain cometh down and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, and giveth seed to the sower, and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper. Now there's a third reason for turning to Jehovah. Because his word is going to accomplish in the life of the individual that which God pleases, that which he wants. So I need to turn to him, thereby I become what he would have me to be. Fourth is the fourth four. Right? For ye shall go out with joy, and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth before thee, for you into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. That's just a figure of speech, of course. But now notice it. You'll go forth with joy. There are no hurries from Egypt here, but you're going forth. Your life is one of joy in him. And be led forth with peace. Now here are joy and peace. Two things the New Testament talks about so much. These will be yours as you go forth under this new David. He's talking about the last thought here. And so here would be the trees and the field will clap their hands over you. Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to Jehovah for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. So that which you see in the true saints of God today, peace and joy, in him redemption, all of that is our present day monuments, and I don't need a miracle to convince me that God is. Here, what I have, the peace, the joy, the salvation, the redemption, the glorious hope, all of these are witnesses, testimonies, and assurances that God has hope. These are great chapters. That 52nd and 3rd, I mean, back there, the one back was very bad, the condition of Zion, depressed, down, cast down, as a drunken woman in a drunken stupor because of the judgment come upon them. Here's the servant that came to redeem. Here now is the redeemed Zion today under Christ. And here's the invitation to come and partake of that to all the world. That's just almost New Testament gospel, isn't it? That's just as if that's what the New Testament preached. So what you have back here, find its fulfillment in Christ and in the New Testament. I hope that these studies, I know sometimes they get a little monotonous. It's so long. The book is so long. We kind of lose sight of where we are. But I just hope that the study will encourage you to read the book often, study it, and let it mean much to you. Next time, we'll take chapter 56 and 57, and the class is excused. Unless you have a question, you might have a question. All right, class is excused.